In the nation of Georgia, a tense standoff over a proposed bill that could hinder the media and a win for the people in the streets.
The government blinked.
But some say that victory may be short-lived. Also ahead, Ukraine may be at war, but Ukrainian athletes are still competing, creating some frosty feelings. This Ukrainian fencer says she used to be friends with Russian fencers. Now they don't speak.
Silence. Just silence.
I'm Carol Hills. Plus, how an artist's training in both China and the U.S. impacts the themes he depicts in his work.
My exploration of the idea of belonging to a place, an idea of home, migration.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Protesters who have spent the past 3 days and nights battling riot police in Georgia's capital, Tbilisi, are celebrating today, at least for now. The demonstrators are applauding a statement by the ruling Georgian Dream Party that says lawmakers will withdraw plans to introduce a foreign agents law. The measure would have required media organizations and NGOs that get more than 20% of their funding from abroad to register as foreign agents. It's similar to a Russian law that targets journalists and activists there. For more context, we reached out to Georgian journalist Natalia Antalava. She's the co-founder of the outlet Coda Story and joins us from New York. Natalia, what's your reaction to the news that Georgia's ruling party says it's rolling back this controversial legislation?
It certainly is a victory because it's a very direct result of protests that have gone on for the last 3 days. They have been massive. They have been loud. The protesters have been determined and undeterred by the violence that has unfolded. The government has been using water cannon and gas, but protests went on and on. So the government blinked. There is certainly a sense of a victory, but there is a lot of apprehension as well. A lot of people, many people are really concerned that the government has also said they will launch a public campaign and go to all the towns and villages explaining to people why this law is a good idea. And people are really worried about that because obviously the government has the resources to launch this massive PR campaign. And many protesters, many Georgians out who are out in the streets again tonight are saying that this is just not going to fly.
So it could be just a delaying tactic and the Georgian government could hope the storm of protest dies down and then they kind of try again.
It most certainly feels like that because, of course, this protest didn't come out of nowhere. They are also a result of a very long simmering tension that has been really heightened by the war in Ukraine. Georgia is a very pro-Western country. After centuries of Russian domination, Georgia sees its future with Europe, and it's written in the Georgian constitution. So that government's departure from that course that has been agreed on is something that people are not accepting.
So why is that? Why is the government at odds with the population?
It's very simple, because the Georgian government is really run by a billionaire who has made his money in Russia in the 1990s, who still has very strong links with Moscow, who cannot openly be pro-Russian because the Georgian people will never accept a pro-Russian politician, but who basically is dancing to the Moscow's tunes. And the war in Ukraine has made that very apparent.
But he was democratically elected. So how did that
work? Indeed. He came also on a promise on continuing on the European course, which, you know, ultimately clashed with his business interests, with his past, with his affiliation with Moscow. And we're seeing the results of that clash. So it kind of feels like the country is on the plane that has been hijacked, except everyone got on the plane on their own will, like no one was forced onto the plane. So it makes it a very tricky situation.
How does the war in Ukraine figure into this equation, into this latest drama?
I think the key thing to understand is that for most Georgians, that war is the extension of the war that they fought and continue to fight with Russia. 20% of Georgia is occupied by Russia. Georgia has fought several wars with Russia since the collapse of the Soviet Union, but also before, you know, Georgia was occupied by the Soviet troops in the 1920s. That was the end of the Georgian independence. It was the Bolshevik takeover. So Russia is the enemy for most Georgians, and Russia is fighting the war that many people see as the extension of their own. I mean, the Ukrainian cabinet are the household names. I was talking to a friend recently who was laughing and saying, you know, I don't know names of any of the Georgian ministers. I know every single Ukrainian minister. Georgians are absolutely obsessed with every detail of that war, because I think there is a really clear sense that their future, too, is being decided on the front lines of Ukraine.
Georgian journalist Natalia Antalava, she's the co-founder of the news outlet Coda Story. Thanks so much, Natalia.
Thank you.
When a massive early morning earthquake hit Turkey and northern Syria last month, thousands of people were killed while they were sleeping. In some cases, children were the sole survivors in their families. Other kids were separated from their parents when they were taken to different hospitals after being rescued. Both countries are now racing to match children separated from their families during the quakes. The World's Duri Buscarin reports.
In a video recorded by Mesopotamia Agency, an independent news channel, a Syrian refugee named Mohammed Hamvi is desperately searching for his 15-year-old daughter. He's placed posters with pictures of her in tent camps around the devastated Turkish city of Kahramanmaraş. Hamvi says he believes his daughter is alive because she went out to the store not long before the family's home collapsed on February 6th. He hasn't seen her since. Hamvi says he found a post on social media of an anonymous user claiming to have found his daughter. It included a photo of her ID, but when he contacted the account, Hamvi tells a reporter, it was deleted. He fears his daughter has been kidnapped. In a disaster, unaccompanied minors are among the most vulnerable targets for human traffickers. Dallas psychiatrist Dr. Nora Abdullah says borders become porous to allow aid shipments, and local governments are often destabilized.
Traffickers are always waiting for a situation like this where they come in and they pretend to belong to an NGO, provide food and shelter and clothes, and so slowly start gaining the trust of the families that they come in contact with or that they want to traffic.
Abdullah has run several training sessions for social workers in Syria. Her team heard disturbing anecdotes about people in unmarked vans showing up at distribution sites and posing as aid workers.
They transport food, they transport toys, they transport clothes to see where there is a break at the borders.
Fearing potential kidnappings, the Turkish government has retained custody of children that were rescued from the rubble and separated from their families. It has forbidden international aid groups like Save the Children from working directly with unaccompanied kids. Instead, the organization is instructed to refer parents to a government hotline.
Şöyle, bizim kuruluşlarımızda biz depremden önce de yeteri kadar...
Bekir Kocayit leads the Ankara section of Turkey's Family and Social Services Ministry. He says his office was tasked with identifying 1,900 children who were orphaned or separated from their families in the earthquake and matching them with living relatives. Using the hotline and an internet portal, all but a couple hundred children have been placed with their families or relatives, Kocayit says. Many are being monitored in hospitals. 78 are too young or too badly injured to identify themselves, and no relatives have been able to prove their relationship. It's impossible for the children that we're responsible for to be taken by anyone else, Kocayit says. We have the capacity to care for them, he added, and we see this as our responsibility. Opposition politicians, however, say the number of missing children appears to be higher than the government's official statistics. The Turkish Women and Children Advocacy Center, Morçata, appealed to the UN with concerns that the hotline set up to match missing kids was overloaded and inadequate. Açela Uçan is a volunteer. When families call the hotline, they're told to be patient, that there are too many separated kids, Uçan says. That's not very comforting. For The World, I'm Duri Buscarin.
In India, a 16th century epic poem has ignited a modern day political firestorm. Several politicians say the poem is offensive to women and Dalits, people considered to be at the bottom of India's caste system. Critics want the text to be edited. Protesters have burned copies. Still, for many Hindus, the poem is hugely popular. From Delhi, reporter Sushmita Patak explains.
Jamvant ke bachan suhaaye.
Over seven long cantos or chapters, the poem narrates the life and deeds of Lord Ram, how he's exiled by his stepmother, how he rescues his kidnapped wife, and his triumphant return home. In North India, people gather to chant the text on holy occasions, says Professor Bhavya Tiwari, who teaches comparative literature at the University of Houston.
It's often treated as a sacred text. So, you know, you'll often find the text being kept at people's home in their temples. So it is like the Bible of North India.
The poem is called Ram Charitmanas, and it's popular because it is written in the colloquial Avadhi dialect rather than Sanskrit, which only scholars might understand. Mahatma Gandhi frequently quoted the text in speeches. It has even found its way into Bollywood movies.
But of course, you know, there are verses in Ram Charitmanas that are not very progressive.
In January, Chandrasekhar, a minister from the state of Bihar, said during a speech that the text spreads hatred. Here he is telling a local television network about one verse in particular.
Dhol gamar sudra pasunari sakal tarana ke adhikari.
The verse goes, just like a drum needs to be tightened to function properly, similarly animals, uneducated people, women and those from the lower caste need to be put in their place, Professor Bhavya Tiwari explains. Several politicians have joined the minister in criticizing the text. They all have one thing in common. They are Prime Minister Narendra Modi's opponents and belong to regional parties. And they are looking to appeal to voters ahead of general elections next year.
There is a very popular saying that in India, people don't cast their vote. People vote their caste.
Professor Sanjay Kumar is a political scientist at the Center for the Study of Developing Society in New Delhi. A few decades ago, Kumar says regional parties in North India who champion caste-based quotas in government jobs and education had huge support from people of so-called lower and backward castes. But that's not true anymore.
Regional parties have faced a lot of difficulty during last 10 years in mobilizing the voters just based on the caste.
That's because Modi's party, the BJP, has successfully attracted voters from different castes, Kumar says. It has done so in part through Hindu nationalist politics by appealing to the common Hindu identity of people from different castes. The debate over the poem presents an opportunity for regional parties who've had their support base eroded.
They wanted to use this as an opportunity to bring back caste politics at the forefront. Regional parties saw this as an opportunity to re-enter into Indian politics in a big way.
They are looking to win back voters by reminding them that not every Hindu is treated equally. Why is one Hindu bigger than the other? Asked Tejaswi Yadav, another of Modi's opponents, during a recent speech. The BJP sees the poem's criticism as anti-Hindu hate and has demanded the leaders apologize for their comments. It doesn't want the caste controversy to blow out of proportion, Professor Sanjay Kumar says.
BJP doesn't want anything in the name of caste to come on the forefront because voters' focus may shift towards, you know, they being discriminated by others who belong to the Hindu fold. So I think that is why BJP want to just push anything which is related to caste at the back burner.
As for the poem, Bhavya Tiwari, the literature professor, says editing the problematic verses, as some politicians have suggested, doesn't make much sense.
But what would make sense to me is to give importance to Dalit writings and Dalit cultures and probably investing money in Dalit writings and Dalit cultures.
This isn't the first time the text has sparked controversy, she says, and it likely won't be the last.
Sadar sunahi te tarahi bhav sindhu bina jal jaan.
For The World, I'm Sushmita Pathak in Delhi.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. There are lots of artists who work outside of their home country, but it's not always correct to call them an artist in exile. Yun Feiji is one such artist. He grew up in China, but has been based in the U.S. since the 1990s. His style reflects the fact that his feet are in two worlds. Yun Feiji takes the traditional Chinese landscape painting, but gives it a contemporary feel. His images are often about the modernization of China and the destruction left in its wake. Yun Feiji joins me from his home in New York. Now, you grew up in China in the 1960s and 70s. It was a turbulent time then. It was the Cultural Revolution. And I read that your mother sent you to study with an officer in the People's Liberation Army. The officer was an illustrator. What was that like?
Yes, I grew up in partially in this army base, and there was an army officer there putting together this hand-to-hand combat manual. He tutored me to draw figures and still life, and that's how I started.
And so one of your early assignments was helping to draw a hand-to-hand combat manual, or learning how to draw that. That's interesting.
Yeah.
And you were 10, you were around 10 years old at the time, weren't you?
Yeah, 11 maybe. Yeah, 10, 11. You know, it was very chaotic because my school was totally not functional because all these years during the Cultural Revolution, like the teachers were in trouble, you know, and the school is almost like halfway shut down.
I know you then studied at China's Central Academy of Fine Arts in Beijing. You graduated in 1982. What kind of styles of art did you learn there?
Basically, my teachers were all, you know, some of them kind of banished in Xinjiang or Tibet and different areas and digging ditches or do farming work or factories, not able to make art for about 20 years, you know, because they were young art students, very talented, outspoken. So seeing them come back at that moment, it was really a huge lesson, I think. You know, the artists of previous generation, how they spend their time. A lot of times they couldn't really do the work they wanted to do, but having to basically serving the state for propaganda purposes, you know, I think that really impressed upon me that maybe this environment is, you know, for me as an aspiring artist, at that time, a young person, I really do not want it to repeat their experience, you know. And then, you know, I came to the U.S. at age 21, and a few years later, you know, June 4th, Tiananmen Square protest ended very tragically, and I stayed in the U.S. afterwards, you know.
So as I understand it, in some ways you kind of unlearned what you learned at the Central Academy of Fine Art and embraced more traditional approaches to art. What kind of traditional approaches did you learn?
First of all, it's the calligraphy was very important. So I was interested in calligraphy. Is considered like the foundation for ink painting tradition. And I always very much interested in drawing. And so I was, you know, experimenting, working with the traditional brush and things like that. After I came to the U.S., living in Brooklyn amongst other artists was struggling at the time, seeing a lot of contemporary art and try to figure out what I wanted to do. Eventually, I decided to kind of embrace the approaches. Like it's kind of like reimagining what contemporary art could be like for me as my own work, like what ink painting, to reimagine ink painting. So I feel like that in that area, first of all, there was no one that was doing that. And secondly, it was something that I'm interested in.
Many of your paintings use ink and watercolor on rice paper and mulberry paper. What is it about that approach that you like?
Well, give you example of, you know, I did a group of work, you know, 2022, I went on the trip to visit this building of the Three Gorges Dam and just seeing like about 400 mile radius, huge cities and medium sized ancient towns and thousands of villages were all kind of taken apart by the residents and farmers and town people getting ready to move to somewhere else. You know, it's this really, in a way, shocking and also really eye-opening for me to see this monumental action and a way of changing landscape, changing our ecology, and how is that affecting common people. So make me think about, you know, the propaganda says it's all for progress, the sacrifice, the small home for the big home, and yet the people who are least able to pay this sacrifice, this high price, because they're poor and living in the rural area for the, you know, the public good of the urban development and things really make me think about this idea of time and progress, migration, the idea of belonging to a place and home.
Displacement is a common theme in your work. One of your paintings is called Everything Moved Outside. It was done in 2022. And when I first looked at it, I assumed it was about the pandemic, but it's not. What's it about?
It's just still continuation of my exploration of the idea of belonging to a place and the idea of home, migration. And these people are, you know, sort of putting their belongings outside to get ready to move. And the idea of like, you know, rural versus urban, because many of the displaced people have moved, try to move to the city and try to find work in the city. Basically, they're ending way of life for hundreds of years to start something new. So it's this transition for many people of leaving something behind. And I'm thinking about what you leave behind, what you take with you, and what you might think can be useful for the future, and how to survive and how to use your imagination to kind of recreate yourself in this urban area.
Are you also describing yourself in this theme of displacement? I mean, you're an artist who is no longer working in your homeland, or am I reading too much into that?
Well, I think the interest that I have with the idea of displacement, I spend a lot of time thinking about belonging in the world, art as a sort of a global citizenship, you know, idea of resistance, the artist's role, how to respond adequately to the challenge of our time. You know, so when I just came to the United States, I was thinking a lot about that. You know, I feel like the history I was taught in China was very, very much like a propaganda to justify the people in power. But I really wanted to understand the history for myself. So I think each of these body of work that I have done, you know, the Three Gorges Dam, the displacement work, and the 2008 collapse of financial market in the U.S., 2005 Katrina disaster, and the idea of, you know, rural versus urban development. I feel like, you know, the rural is being kind of like something to hide because everyone is focused on, you know, building the modern city in China. So I feel I wanted to focus on how the rural people coming to the city to work and try to focus my work, my attention to the working people who really make the iPhone you buy, the clothes you wear, really all over the world are made by hand by these people from rural China. And I feel they are this invisible entity.
Yunfei Ji is a Chinese artist who is based in New York. You can see a selection of his work at theworld.org. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Carol.
More stories from around the globe still coming your way this hour. You're with The World. The film All Quiet on the Western Front is up for a bunch of Oscars. Despite the accolades, the latest adaptation of the literary classic is not beloved by all critics.
Because every film that shows war in a way, well, makes war consumable, even makes it, how do you say, agreeable for the viewer.
That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The western Ukrainian city of Lviv has been one of the safest and quietest places in that country since the Russian invasion began last year. But not today. Emergency workers were digging through rubble in Lviv, where at least five people were killed in the early hours this morning. Russia struck energy infrastructure and residential areas across Ukraine. It was the biggest barrage in about a month, more than 80 missiles and drones. Ukraine said it shot down 34 Russian missiles, but others hit parts of Kharkiv in the east, the capital Kyiv, and once again knocked out power at the Zaporizhia nuclear plant. The electricity there was later restored. Despite these ongoing attacks by Russia, many Ukrainians remain focused on trying to live a normal life, including athletes looking ahead to the 2024 Olympic Games in Paris. As for Russian athletes, it's not clear if they will be allowed to compete there. The World's Daniel Offman has our story from Kyiv.
In Ukraine, people seem to agree with their president. In late January, Volodymyr Zelensky said that Russia should not be allowed to use the 2024 Paris Olympics to, quote, promote aggression. The president of the International Olympic Committee, Thomas Bach, doesn't see it that way, though.
Governments should not decide on political grounds who is participating in which sport event. Sport events, the qualification for sports event must be on sporting merits and not on political interference.
In the past, Russian athletes have been allowed to compete in the Olympics under a neutral banner, just not the Russian flag. But when you speak with Ukrainian athletes, they're not convinced. The fencing gym at the National University of Physical Education in Kyiv has hardwood floors and mirrors on one side so the fencers can perfect their footwork.
Hi, my name is Daria Varfolomeeva, and I am a Ukrainian fencer, and I am 23 years old.
Varfolomeeva is from Uzhgorod, a city in western Ukraine bordering Slovakia. She started fencing when she was 11 years old.
My first competition was in Slovakia, and there were like 15 competitors, and I was 14th. So I was really happy that I was not the last. Yeah, but I really enjoyed it.
She enjoyed it so much, she started training 5 days a week for 2 hours a day.
My mom told me if you want to go to do trainings, you have to do all your homework, and only after that you can go to do your training. So I did my homework between lessons, just to have more time. Every day was the same.
Varfolomeeva stuck with it, and she now trains with Ukraine's national fencing team, and she hopes to qualify for the Olympic Games next year. As with so many Ukrainians, the past 12 months have not been easy. When Russia's invasion started in February last year, Varfolomeeva's mother asked her to take her sister abroad.
I didn't want to go, but my mom just asked me, please go. On the second day of war, we left our country. It was a long, long way. And we arrived to Prague, Czech Republic. My sister's godmother living there, so we stayed at her for a few months.
Varfolomeeva says that was a stressful time, and she had a hard time sleeping. But she says she felt welcome in Prague. She was able to train there and then take part in a competition in Budapest.
One of girls and her coaches saw that I don't have my equipment, and they came to me and said, oh, let's go with us. I said, where? Let's go. And then we came fencing equipment shop, and they bought me all equipment, and I was just like crying. I didn't know how to thank them.
Varfolomeeva says she got a lot of support while she was abroad, but her interactions with Russian athletes weren't great. In the past, she used to compete against fencers from Russia and even stayed in touch with some of them.
We've been like friends, but now no one even wrote me, how are you alive, or something else.
So you were friends with some Russian fencers, but when the war began, they stopped talking. They didn't say anything.
Yeah, silence.
When I asked Daria Varfolomeeva whether Russian athletes should be allowed to participate in the Paris Olympics, she says she can't understand why they would even be allowed to compete. On the outskirts of Kyiv, at an Olympic training facility, Greco-Roman wrestler Parviz Nasibov is getting ready for the 2024 Summer Games. Nasibov won the silver medal at the last Summer Olympics in Tokyo. Nasibov says that right now, despite all the training, sports just seems less important. He says he's often thinking about friends who've died in the war or those still serving in Ukraine's armed forces. Of course it's difficult, he says. I haven't seen my family in 2 or 3 months. They fled to Germany last year. Nasibov says he keeps in touch with some Russian wrestlers, but they don't have much to say about the war. And Nasibov says he's lost all respect for them. Nasibov says he hopes the Olympic Committee arrives at the right decision. which in his opinion would be to ban Russian athletes. Russia uses sports for propaganda purposes, he says. Nasibov says his goal remains the same, to win a gold medal in Paris. And if Russian athletes are allowed to compete, he says we'll just have to beat them. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
The Oscars are this weekend, and getting a lot of buzz in several categories is the German adaptation of the literary classic All Quiet on the Western Front. It's up for 9 Academy Awards. The famous German novel follows a young man, a soldier, in the trenches in World War I. It was originally adapted for the screen in 1930. The latest film is the third version. Lots of battle scenes in both films, the most recent one using 21st century technology to depict the horrors of the First World War, often in vivid, terrifying detail. We were interested in a German perspective on the film, so we reached out to Andreas Kilb. He's the Berlin cultural correspondent for the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung newspaper. He spoke with The World's Marco Werman.
Andreas, this is the third film adaptation of Erich Maria Remarque's novel, but it's the first German adaptation. The director, Edward Berger, do you think the German perspective makes this film fundamentally different from its predecessors?
Well, that's at least what Edward Berger says. But when I see the film, I have to place it more in a very American, or let's say Hollywood tradition, of war movies. Because the film centers on war in a way, in an action-driven way, that I can hardly associate with German cinema.
What is the German tradition of war cinema?
I'd say the German tradition of war cinema is more in the way of Louis Milestone's classical film from 1930, a tradition that sees war as an inner experience, as an inner drama, and not as an action-driven hell like it's presented here.
There were some significant changes, as I'm sure you know, that were made to the story from the original novel in this version. The book is entirely from the perspective of a young soldier. This movie spends periods following the negotiations for the Armistice Treaty, ending the fighting of World War I. What do you think of those departures?
Well, I think they take the essence out of the story, because the essence of the story is that it's a tale of alienation. It's a tale of alienation from the world, from the home front, from the family that this Paul Bäumer soldier comes from. It's a total isolation from everything he has believed and been taught before this war. I think Erich Maria Remarque's book is the story of an experience that the author made, whereas the film is the story of a panorama that is designed by professional filmmakers who kind of want to fill in a bigger picture. The soldier's experience is only one part in this picture. The key sense of the book is erased.
So you're critical of the movie, Andreas, but where do you think it succeeds?
In the optics. It's, of course, visually beautifully done. And the contrast between the natural beauty that unfolds in the first scenes and the absolute devastation in the trenches is visually striking. You cannot deny this. And of course, the basic storytelling by Edward Berger is a virtuoso thing. I cannot reproach the film of its professionalism. I'd only say it has taken the heart out of the story and replaced it by a Hollywood mechanic that works, but works in destroying the inbound sense of the narration.
The original novel, All Quiet on the Western Front, is often referred to as an anti-war novel because it depicts the horrors and futility of war, especially trench warfare. But you wrote in your review that there are no anti-war films. Can you explain that?
Well, anti-war films would be films that don't show war, because every film that shows war in a way, well, makes war consumable, even makes it, how do you say, agreeable for the viewer. To show war means to advertise war, to put it bluntly. But there are anti-war films which tell or speak about the devastations of war in an indirect way. They exist. Hiroshima Mon Amour could be considered, the old L.A. René classic, could be considered an anti-war movie, but not films that show war.
I think of MASH. I mean, I'm not going to have a debate, but MASH is a great okay. anti-war film that takes place in the middle of war. I have to say, though, what All Quiet on the Western Front, Berger's adaptation, what it does in an exceptionally nuanced way is get that message through that war is hell, and that hell is often engineered in the halls of power with little regard for the people who pay the highest price with their lives. How can that be seen as anything but an anti-war film?
Still, there are winners, and there are bad guys and good guys. So the French win, and they're in the right. How is that not a pro-war stance? It's a war against the bad guys. So I wouldn't say it's anti-war. It's anti-German war.
Andreas Kilb is the Berlin cultural correspondent for the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung newspaper. He joined us from Berlin. Thank you very much for speaking with us. This is fascinating.
Thank you very much.
The film adaptation of All Quiet on the Western Front is nominated for 9 Academy Awards. The Oscars are this Sunday. It was another day of disruption on the streets of Israeli cities today. In Jerusalem, protesters were shouting shame at police officers clashing with demonstrators. People are angry with Israel's right-wing government for moving forward with plans to limit the power of the judiciary. Protests outside of Tel Aviv also hindered access to Israel's main airport, and crowds gathered outside the homes of several government ministers. Then there was a confrontation between police and demonstrators at the office of an Israeli think tank. The Kohelet Policy Forum is a far-right organization that wrote the bill aimed at curtailing Israel's Supreme Court. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has more on that.
There's a strong culture of protest in Israel, but what's been playing out for 10 weeks now is something different.
The Israeli population is outraged and up in arms because they feel their democracy is being destroyed.
Alison Kaplan Summer is a journalist with Haaretz newspaper in Tel Aviv.
They're struggling, they're fighting, and you see the passion in the demonstrators. They're fighting as hard as they can to try to preserve the country that they thought that they were raised in, that they thought it was a democracy.
Kaplan Summer says, imagine, if you will, that the American president and Congress were trying to pass a law that would neutralize the U.S. Supreme Court.
If the legislation as it stands now is passed, There will be no power in the Supreme Court, and that is in a country where we don't even have a separation of powers between the president and Congress. So it's basically you're creating a situation in whatever the prime minister wants goes.
According to an investigation by Haaretz, this bill was written by the Kohelet Forum, the Israeli think tank that was started in 2013 by an American immigrant to Israel, Moshe Koppel, and heavily funded by American billionaires. The group generally stands for 3 things. 1, free market economics. 2, Jewish nationalism and the expansion of Jewish settlements in the Palestinian territories. And 3, judicial restraint, especially when it comes to Israel's Supreme Court. Dr. Chaim Katzman studies the rise of political conservatives in Israel.
The Supreme Court in Israel is perceived by some parts of the Israeli society as extremely liberal and as an institution that is blocking the right-wing governments from implementing the policies they want to do.
Especially, Katzman says, when it comes to the Palestinian territories.
Most policies Israel implemented in the West Bank, whether it's occupying the West Bank or moving settlers to settle in the West Bank, or confiscating land from Palestinians, I would say more than 90% of these the Supreme Court upheld.
But in some cases, he says, where there were crystal clear violations of Israeli law, the Supreme Court has occasionally ruled in favor of Palestinian rights.
This really happened only a few times, but even those few times were perceived by the right wing as a threat on the occupation and on the settlement project.
The Kohelet think tank has a stable of researchers and a big budget to produce position papers. They write model legislation. They send out reports to lawmakers recommending how to vote on bills. In other words, Kohelet is essentially operating like an American think tank. And that's no surprise, says Allison Kaplan-Summer, given where the group's funding comes from. Her newspaper reports that the Kohelet Forum gets tens of millions of dollars from two Jewish-American multi-billionaires, Arthur Danchik and Jeffrey Yass.
And they're both big contributors to the what's called the Club for Growth, which is an organization that fights corporate income and tax regulation. It's also supported politicians who spread conspiracy theories about the 2020 election.
Kaplan-Summer says these two billionaires could radically alter the way democracy works in the Jewish state.
Because there are fewer bulwarks in Israeli law against changing the system than there are in the United States, it's much, much easier for them to back Netanyahu transforming the way that democracy works in Israel than it would have been for them to back fundamental change in American democracy by Donald Trump.
The Kohelet Forum says it doesn't reveal the identity of its donors, but it did make the following public statement in 2021. We are not experts on relations between citizen and administration in the United States, but we welcome everyone who promotes the good of Israel in Israel and abroad. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Despite years of calls for its closure, the detention camp at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba remains open. Over the years, the American government has held a total of 780 detainees there. That number has dwindled. Today, only 31 detainees remain. Many of the others have been sent home or released to other nations. To tell us more about the process of detainee resettlement is New York Times correspondent Carol Rosenberg. She joins us from Miami. Carol, in the past few days, we've learned about some new detainee releases. The United States released a Saudi citizen, Ghassan al-Sharbi, to Saudi Arabia. What do we know about him and his release?
He is one of the people who was cleared for release early on in the Biden administration when they got the review boards back up and running. He was captured in Pakistan in 2003 and brought to Guantanamo as a suspected bomb maker. About a year and a half ago, went before the board, and he was approved for release. He's gone back to Saudi Arabia, and the expectation is he'll be in the rehab center that the Saudis run there for returning jihadists.
Now, another case worth highlighting is that of Majid Khan. He's a Pakistani national whose torture by the CIA is well documented. Now he's been released to Belize. Why Belize?
Yeah, it's one of the most interesting deals to come out of all the people who've left Guantanamo. You know, he went to high school outside of Baltimore and is very Americanized in some ways. His family lives in the United States, but by law, he can't come into the United States. So a very creative thinking diplomat over at the State Department looked around the world and persuaded Belize that they should give this guy a chance. And as the foreign minister of Belize told me recently, they want him to become a good Belizean citizen. So they're really giving him a shot at a new life.
How does the conversation go around the U.S. persuading nations to take former detainees in?
So you've just struck the whole issue that is confronting the State Department right now. Repatriations is one thing, convincing a country to take their citizen back and help them reenter society. The U.S. has been somewhat successful at doing that. But there are people who've gone to Guantanamo who cannot go home. What the U.S. State Department does is basically a kind of matchmaking effort. They look for countries that will be doing the United States the favor of taking these people. We knew in Belize, for example, that the Belizean government insisted on a pile of cash to resettle him, to buy the house, and they're buying him a car, and the U.S. pays for resettlement fees or programs. But there's a matter of appealing to countries on humanitarian grounds. There's a matter of appealing to countries on human rights grounds. You know, the world condemned Guantanamo, or much of the world did. And so the campaign, when it's been active under Obama and now under President Biden, is to say, you want Guantanamo closed? Help us close it by taking these people.
Now, there's this perennial question, which you just started to answer in terms of why the detention center at Guantanamo Bay remains open. Is it just about finding countries who will accept the detainees, or is there something more that's keeping this detention camp open?
The issue of closing Guantanamo long ago became not really closing it, but moving it, creating something called Guantanamo North and taking back to the United States, or taking into the United States, the few men who are either convicted, facing trial, or the U.S. will not let go. You know, they realized that there was some population of prisoners that they would never let go. Five of the men down there are accused of plotting the 9/11 attacks. They've been charged off and on since 2008 in these military commission trials that have yet to become trials. And now there's talks about exchanging guilty pleas for life sentences. So potentially these five men could be serving life in U.S. detention, if not at Guantanamo, at Guantanamo North, somewhere in the United States.
Carol Rosenberg is the New York Times correspondent who's been covering the detention camp at Guantanamo Bay since it opened. She's been speaking to us from Miami, Florida. Carol, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Israeli actor Haim Topol died today at age 87. The world's Anna Kussmer has more on his life and legacy.
The second you hear those first few strings, you are transported to the small Ukrainian shtetl Anna Tevka and the hulking teddy bear, burly milkman, and loving girl dad of five, Tevya, who takes you in.
You might say every one of us is a fiddler on the roof, trying to scratch out a pleasant, simple tune without breaking his neck.
Israeli actor Chaim Topol started playing Tevya in his late 20s and starred in stage productions of Fiddler on the Roof more than 3,500 times throughout his life.
If I were a wealthy man, I...
For many, Topol is synonymous with Tevya, a part he cherished. Here he is talking to NBC when he reprised the role in 2009.
I love Tevya. I love Tevya mainly because it's one of the best parts ever written for a male actor singer.
Like Tevya, Topol's own roots were Eastern European. In another 2009 interview at a Memphis theater where he was performing, Topol said he himself came from a long line of Tevyas.
So for me, it's definitely something very dear to kind of commemorating my heritage, my family.
When Topol became Tevya on stage, he portrayed candid conversations with God and a sentimentality and love for his family. He said he melted into the character every night, crying as he said goodbye to Tevya's daughter, bound for Siberia.
Papa! God alone knows when we shall see each other again.
Then we will leave it in his hands.
Born in Tel Aviv in 1935, Topol got his theatrical start performing for Israeli soldiers. His death was announced by the Israeli government today. In 2012, one of Israel's leading newspapers referred to Topol as, quote, Israel's most famous export since the Jaffa Orange. The fiddler motif in the famous play is about the precarity of Jewish people carrying on life despite the danger, something that Topol felt deeply offstage as well. His baritone voice had a natural gravity. In 2012, he sang a famous poem in Hebrew at the Auschwitz concentration camp memorial in Poland. The poem is commonly known as Eli Eli, written by Hungarian-Jewish World War II resistance fighter Hanna Senesh. It's about praying that life will go on, the sand, the sea, and the voices of the people who forever changed us. For The World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.